Tonight, it's a real pleasure to have a panel. Near-death experiences mean different things to different people, and the experiences themselves mean something different to the experiencers than probably anyone else. It's fascinating to me when I hear people try to understand minute details from near-death experiences, because you hear questions from, why are there starving people in China? Why is there war in the Middle East? Most of that is just absolutely not part of near-death experiences. It would be a little bit like having some kind of a time machine and being able to send somebody from ancient Rome to the United States to hang out here for, an hour, 10 minutes? I don't know. Some of the longest near-death experiences, maybe a few hours. Then having them magically transported to Rome and having a bunch of people argue over American politics from what they heard from somebody. We just don't get a huge amount of information from near-death experiences about the next life to really decide religious questions, other questions that sometimes people ask about. But having said that, there is a lot you can learn. I mean, if you had somebody come from a different place that you had never been to, even if they only visited for a short time, you can learn a lot from what they have to say. And so the information that we have about some of the most important things, near-death experiences can really, really speak to. People are becoming more and more knowledgeable about near-death experiences. Before our meeting started, I heard a conversation up in the foyer about people going through the list of the commonly known 17 elements of near-death experiences. And those are counted up different ways, but if you were to come up with a basic near-death experience, it might be something like somebody has a traumatic accident or event in their life, and they feel a ringing or a buzzing sound in their ears. They feel themselves pop out or somehow leave their physical body. They look down and see their physical body below them. They have a feeling of disorientation in the sense that they're not quite yet sure what's happening. And as they hover there over their body, they come to the realization that that's their physical body below them. That must mean that they're dead because they're not down there anymore. And often they will try to talk to loved ones or someone else and realize that they're not perceived or noticed by the people who are still alive. And then at some point, they often see a tunnel or a conduit open up above them, and they just feel drawn through that tunnel. There have been some experiencers who have discussed and described what the tunnel was like, but they seem drawn to it. And often they see at the end of the tunnel this incredible being of light who is variously described by some as God or the ultimate being or an angel or Jesus or some other religious figure, depending on your background. There are other elements. Often older people will have a complete life review that they describe as every single thing that ever happened to them from the instant of birth through that time, displayed before them sort of all at once, immediately after being asked by God or this being of light, what have you done with your life to show me? And then your life is all there. They describe no judgment about that, but extreme love as you go through all those things in your life that are good, maybe not so good, maybe a little bit embarrassing, maybe quite an experience, one of the most profound aspects. And from there, obviously these people have come back. Some are told that they have to come back. Some are told that they need to make a choice. Inevitably, if we're talking to them, they chose to come back, mostly for family or for some unfulfilled responsibility that they're told or feel themselves that they have. Some people wind up seeing on the other side family members or other friends or relatives. Some people see pets. Other people see various scenes, locations. Some people have described beautiful meadows. Some have described libraries, places of learning, amazing buildings. Others have described cities of light in a far-off location that they were only able to glimpse from a distance. There are those who have seen negative places. People who weren't exactly the greatest in this life have seen some real harsh places and been told you need to change because you don't want to be here with people like this who are not so great. You need to change. You have those kinds of explanations given to some people. I could go on about some other elements, but those are some of the basic ones. The fascinating thing to me is that near-death experiences from an individual never have all of the elements. Maybe it's a little bit like going to Paris. You could never see it all in a little bit of time, but you would all see some of it. What I'm going to do at this point is hand the microphone first to Bill English and then to Liz Clark and then to Jeff Olson for them to tell their experience as they experienced it and think about the elements that happened in their specific case. After we're done hearing from all three of them, we'll talk about what happened to them and why and what the elements mean and whatever other questions you might have. I think it'll be a fun opportunity to be a little bit more interactive than some of our presentations that we've had here. It will give people a chance to maybe learn in a little bit more detail what near-death experiences are all about. Bill, here you go.
My experience actually began July 26, 1991. I was in a serious accident up in Idaho. I was flown by helicopter to the Eastern Idaho Regional Medical Center, was kind of lapsing in and out of consciousness. I remember being in the emergency room and the doctors kind of going through the nature of my injuries at that time. The nature of my injuries were closed head injury. I had a cervical injury. I had a burst fracture at T4 in my back, a compression fracture at T5, a pneumothorax, a hemothorax, traumatic pancreatitis. Those were the initial injuries. They couldn't treat me because of the nature of my trauma there. So the decision was made, do I either go to Boise, which is a Trauma One center, or to Salt Lake City? My brother was with me at the time of the accident, and he said, we're from Salt Lake, let's fly him down there. So I was flown down to Salt Lake City. Prior to leaving the hospital, I knew the extent of my injuries. I knew that I was paralyzed, and they were asking me for consent to treat me. And at that time, the thought of being paralyzed was really more frightening to me than dying. And so when the doctors asked for my consent to treat me, I said, no, just let me die. They were kind of put into a quandary. Then my brother arrived at the hospital sometime after, and they talked to him. And we had a pretty lengthy discussion, and he went back out and he said, you know, I have to really respect his wishes. He's being rational, and if this is a choice he's making, I have to respect it, but let's fly him to Salt Lake. I was flown to Salt Lake City. I lapsed into a coma and was in a coma for several weeks. Prior to lapsing into a coma, I started to develop a number of complications. ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome, and I started to develop pneumonia, and after that a haemophilus, an infection of the blood. Pretty much during, I believe it was about a six-week period of time, I had arrested several times. My family had been told, I think about seven different times, my family was told, you know, you need to say your goodbyes, he's just not going to make it. That was kind of the basis of the injuries that took me to my experience. The first experience I had was actually when I was in the intensive care unit at UMed Center. My brother Bob, who had flown back down on the plane with me, my mother was living in California, and my youngest brother was in Puerto Rico in the military. So the only family that I had here locally were my kids, who were off with their mother on a trip, and my cousin. And my brother had tried to get a priest in the hospital to come in and give me last rites based on what the doctors had shared with them. And I guess they were having trouble finding a priest, so Bob called my cousin Tom and asked if he would come to the hospital and give me a blessing, because I really needed all the help I could get. Tom and my brother Bob's brother-in-law Lance came to the hospital for the purpose of giving me a blessing. At the time they arrived at the hospital, like I said, I was in a coma. I was on a respirator, or a ventilator, excuse me, and from what they tell me, I guess pretty much hooked up to everything they had. They had to kind of wind their way around the equipment and give me the blessing. As they were giving me the blessing, it was really interesting in the sense that I was in a coma, but yet I could see it from an elevated position. I was looking down. I could feel their hands on my head, and I could hear what they were saying. And as they were actually giving me the blessing, a circle was being formed around me where people were gathering around the bed that I was lying on, and they were placing their hands on me. And all I could really sense is that they were healing hands. But these people that were forming around me were some I knew, some I had a familiarity with. I mean, in other words, I knew all of them, but these were deceased relatives. These were people that some were known to me, some were unknown to me, but I knew all of them. I just had a sense that they were placing healing hands on me as Tom and Lance were in there giving me this blessing. It was kind of peculiar at that time because I was really confused. It was like I was trying to reconcile, who's the person on the bed? Why is it that I think it's me, but I'm looking at it from this elevated position? The group kind of formed around me. That's all I remember about that particular aspect of the experience. I'll share one other thing, is that as these people were gathering around me and the hands were placed on me, just this incredible peace and resolve kind of came over me that it was going to be okay. The next experience was probably about 6 weeks later. And the reason that I believe it was about 6 weeks later is that was about how long I was in the coma. My condition, like I said, had been up and down, and unfortunately, about the last several weeks, it was more down than up. And it was at the point where the doctors had been actively involved in conversation with the family about removing me from life support, that they had really no idea of what kind of quality of life I would have based on my injuries, and that if I did survive, in all likelihood, I would be institutionalized for the rest of my life. And so there were some active conversations going on at that time about removing me from life support. As I indicated, I had developed this condition called ARDS. Well, at the time I developed ARDS, the mortality rate for that alone was about 90-95%. They were saying, just given the nature of my injuries and then the other complications that had developed, the chances of me surviving were next to nothing. The next aspect of the experience was, all of a sudden, I found myself out of my body again, but this time I found myself in a beautiful meadow, a place that was just incredibly beautiful. The grounds, the flowers, the trees, the sky, everything was beautiful, but what really struck me was how interconnected everything was. I felt like everything was communicating and everything was at the same level. I mean, even though they were different, everything was the same. Everything was really united in kind of one common element, if you will. I was struck by how incredibly beautiful it was, and I was on this pathway, and the path kind of went down a slight grade, and then it went off to the left, and off to the left there was this archway. I could see that there was like a garden down in there, and there was a light that was drawing me towards this arch. And so I started down the path, and as I was going down this path, it was almost like somebody had really reached in and literally ripped my heart out. I mean, it was a pain an emotional pain like nothing I had ever felt. And what I was really feeling at that point in time was, I'm never going to have the opportunity to really tell my children that I love them. Going back in time, I mean, prior to the accident, I loved my children, but I was kind of, I guess, the poster child for type A personality, and it was, I showed my love by giving them things. And what they really wanted was, they wanted a relationship with me. They didn't really want a relationship with the things that I gave them. I could never really understand, the conversations would come up like, well, you don't love us. And I'd go, well, how can you say I don't love you? Look at all the things I've given you. It's kind of like, you don't get it. It's not about things. It's about wanting a relationship with you. And when this accident happened to me and I was on this path, it finally, I guess, the bell went off. It was like, I am not going to have the opportunity to really have that relationship with my children and to rectify it with them. I continued down the path. This light was emanating through this archway. And as I entered into this archway, it was a beautiful garden area. And directly ahead of me was my father. And my dad had actually died 6 years prior to my accident. And I was just awestruck by how good he looked. He looked healthy, vibrant. We came together and, he embraced me. And really, it was a very brief conversation that we had. I told my dad, I said, I'm really lost and confused, because when I found myself up in that meadow, I knew I either had died or I was in the process of dying. And when I met my dad, I told him, I said, I'm really lost and confused. And he embraced me and he said, it's not your time to be with me now. You need to go back. When it's your time, I'll be here waiting for you. I went back towards the archway, and that's really kind of all I remember. When I came back, well, right at that time medically, it was almost, I still run into doctors and that occasionally now, that after 20-something years, they still call me the miracle baby, because they pretty much had written me off. And then all of a sudden, I mean, just things turned around and I really started to rally. And within a matter of a week or so, I was conscious and I was starting to be weaned off of the ventilator. When I was able to communicate verbally with my mother and brother, my mother and my youngest brother were there, and they were like, God, how are you? You know, I mean, are you okay? Because they didn't quite know what to expect, because they knew that there had been a head injury. I said, I'm fine. I've been with Dad. And you would think with a statement like that, that people would be hitting the call buttons like, you need to get somebody in here. This guy's definitely got a head injury. But there was total acceptance. Why I said I think Kay might be of some benefit here, the thing that was very interesting for a number of weeks while I was still in the intensive care, it was almost like I still had one foot in to that realm and one foot here. And there was this aura, this energy that was around me. It just really blew my mind, because literally there were, I can't even tell you how many people came, but I know that the hospital was really pissed off, and they were telling people, you need to call and kind of get a number before you come up, and were really limiting visitation because I guess it was so disruptive to the intensive care unit. But when I finally was able to really talk to people, I was kind of overwhelmed, because I'd always had friends, but I think because of my type A personality or whatever, I mean, it was more like acquaintances. I was always kind of moving on to the next thing, the next project or whatever. And so when all of these people were coming and expressing their concern and care, it was just overwhelming to me. And I was going, you know, what's this all about? And they're going, you don't get it. We are getting so much just coming here, being with you. I don't understand what you're getting. I really felt like I said, I was connected between these two places. And this went on for, like I said, several weeks. The other aspect of the experience was bits and pieces of what I had actually experienced started kind of falling into place. It wasn't like I was given everything at one shot. It was kind of like when I was really ready to hear the message, I'd get another piece of the puzzle. I mean, I can tell you from my perspective, I came back with a lot more questions than answers. I mean, I wasn't one of these people that was fortunate enough that they laid it all out and said, okay, here's the roadmap. They kind of gave me a blank piece of paper and said, well, figure out where you're going from here. You'll be fine. Thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Liz.
My name's Liz Clark, and I had my near-death experience when I was about 14 years old. I wasn't actually a really happy child about that point in time in my life. My NDE kind of falls into a different category because I died of a drug overdose. It wasn't an intentional drug overdose, but nonetheless, it was a drug overdose. One of the first things I remember was looking at down and seeing my body on the bed, and I was like, wow, I wonder who that is. And then I realized it was me, and then I thought, oh man, my mom's going to be pissed. She's going to be so mad because I'm dead. She's going to be really upset. At that point, I was drawn into this tunnel, and I saw this pinpoint of light in the distance. I remember looking at my hands, and I had this white kind of robe on. And I remember seeing the pinpoint of light in the distance, and I thought, well, I wonder what that pinpoint of light is. And instantly, I was at that pinpoint of light. It came into a room where there were people who were kind of like I was, more of a little bit of a rowdy crowd, maybe. I remember I had noticed that I had this black spot on my white robe, and I knew what it meant. I knew at that moment what that was to me. I tried to hide it, and everybody in the room started laughing because they all knew that I was trying to hide. I crouched down, and I cried out, and there was a light coming towards me. In this light, the being said my name. He came, and he hugged me. And at that moment, I started my life review, and I saw all of these things, and I felt this pain that was immense. And it was like being a drop of water in a million gallons of lemon juice, and the lemon juice being the pain, and I was the drop of water. It consumed me with all of the things I had done. I kept feeling this, and this person was holding me and just hugging me, and then he told me, I felt this love coming from him. I realized all of a sudden that the pain wasn't coming from him. It was coming from me. It was what I placed on it. I felt love coming from him. And at that point, it reversed, a million gallons being of water, being love, and I was the one drop of lemon juice in the water. And it consumed every part of me. He just asked me, and it wasn't a very condemning question. He just asked me if I knew what I had done was, and I did. He proceeded to show me all these different people that had been in my life that had hurt me up to that point, and he showed me all the things that they had happened to them that made them like they were, that they had had all these experiences that created what he called a virus. He said, these people, it's like having a cold, he says, and they keep passing it on to each other by what they do. He says, but you don't have to pass on the illnesses. You can stop it. You can make something good out of it. Then I was taken to this room and told that I had to come back, and I was like, no, I'm not going back. And so they showed me a bunch of stuff that I needed to do and asked me if I was ready to go back, and I was like, no, I'm not going back. And so they showed me more things. In this room, there's this white stone, and I could see into it all of these things I needed to do. And the third time, after they showed me the third time, they says, okay, are you ready to go back? And I said, oh, no, I'm not going back. I've been there. I don't want to go back there. And so this being took me into the presence of a higher being. It was kind of like talking with my dad, and he can talk me into pretty much anything. And he just said, well, you know, this isn't really where you want to be. You want to move on. And I was like, I like it here. And he talked me into it. Long story short, I said okay. I ended up getting put back into my body, but not willingly. It changed my life after that dramatically. I often think that that person stayed dead, and I came back somebody new, a different person anyway.
My experience was quite like Bill's, and we've never really shared this on a personal basis like this. I was in a very bad automobile accident. It crushed both of my legs. It broke my back, but did not sever the spinal cord. Crushed my ribs, pulled my right shoulder out very badly and cut the arm, and then the seatbelt came right through my midsection and ruptured all my insides into all the open wounds of the legs. At that time, I was traveling with our whole family. My wife and my two sons were in the car, and the most tragic part of that is my wife and youngest son were killed instantly at the accident. My oldest son and I survived. So I was 33 years old at the time. My wife was 31. My oldest son who survived with me was 7 years old at the time, and the youngest boy that I lost was just 14 months. He was just a little baby. It was devastating. I remember being crashed. I don't necessarily recall what caused the crash, but we were crashed, and I could hear my oldest son crying in the back seat, which was actually a relief because I knew he was okay. If he was crying, I knew he was well enough to be crying, and he was actually audibly talking to me, and I was conscious, and I kept telling him it was going to be okay, but I knew it was not going to be okay. I felt myself slipping. I knew that my wife, who was seated next to me, and my baby son were gone, and the trauma of that was enough to kill me in addition to the injuries. But I felt myself slipping away into darkness at first, but then it was almost as if I was in a bubble of light. And I say that because I was really quite unaware of anything but about 5 feet around me. And yet in that light was my deceased wife. Although I had passed from this life somewhat, she was quite distraught, and she was saying, "You can't be here. You can't be here. You've got to go back. You've got to leave. You can't be here." And here we were saying this goodbye in a way, and yet I knew my oldest son was in the car crying. I knew I had to get back to him somehow. And I'm going to be very brief too, because I would much rather leave time to answer questions. I left this bubble of light. I was no longer at the accident scene. I seemed to be above it. But my wife was telling me, "You can't stay here, you have to leave." And as soon as I thought of my son who was back there, knowing that if I didn't go back, he would be left orphaned, I found myself walking through a hospital. So I have no sense of time. I don't know what time was going on. But as I came to my consciousness, I was moving through the hospital and I was encountering doctors and nurses and patients. But I realized that they were completely unaware of me. I was not injured. I was moving at will. As I encountered these people, I knew them perfect. I don't know how to explain this, but I knew them as well as I knew myself, and I loved them. I knew their hate. I knew their pain. I knew their love. I knew their sorrow. I knew their joys. I knew every decision they had made, but I also knew every motivation behind every decision that it had. I knew them as well as I knew myself. I had this immense love. I wanted to embrace them all as if they were family, and yet they were strangers just in the hospital. I did not experience a life review or even a tunnel. I just had risen above the scene of the accident. My wife sent me back, and then I was encountering these people in my spirit self, and I had the overwhelming question hit me, which was very profound, that said, "To what degree have you learned to love?" At the same time, I was experiencing this immense, unconditional, overwhelming love for every soul that I encountered. And I finally worked my way around the hospital and in other rooms, and I encountered a man laying on the bed that I felt nothing from. I thought, well, that's odd, and I moved closer, and I remember looking at this, and it was almost repulsive to me, and yet I loved it. It was this heap of flesh, and as I moved closer, I looked and realized it was me. I was looking at myself or my body. It wasn't like I wasn't aware that I was out of the body, but that was the very poignant moment to say, wow, that's me, and yet it's not me because I'm here, and I'm looking at my body. And I remember looking at the injuries and just thinking, what a mess, and knowing the pain that I had experienced at the scene of the accident, and then also having the grief of I knew what had happened, half my family was gone, But as soon as I had the thought, I've got to get back in the body, I was back in the body. And then it was intense, immense emotional and physical pain. I was actually in the hospital for almost 6 months. I had 18 surgeries as they put me together. And Bill, you put it eloquently, I had one foot in the spirit world and one foot in this world almost the whole time. During that, I got severe infections because of all the open wounds that had my guts spilled into them. I also threw not one but two pulmonary embolisms, which are they're blood clots that would lodge in my lungs and other places. And I was just in and out of ICU. I was respirated because my lungs wouldn't work properly, and my rib cage had been crushed. And it was just, I was an absolute mess. So for almost 6 months, I was in the hospital, and I had profound experiences. I received a blessing as well in the hospital, and yet I was almost, we had such a similar experience. I saw every face of each person that was in this circle around me as they put hands on me, but it was strange because I had searched mission in Scotland, and my favorite missionary companion that lived in England was one of these faces. And then I saw my father, and I saw my brothers, and then I saw a friend of the family, but is also he's a leader in the LDS church, a guy named Jeffrey R. Holland, and he was there. And at the time, I thought, this just can't be, because why is Graham here, my missionary companion, and what is Elder Holland doing here? I later found out that was the people that were there. Graham had happened to be in town and had heard about the accident and had come to the hospital and was there. So it wasn't deceased ancestors, but it was literally people that were living and were here. But as I encountered each of the people, I had this profound feeling of the connection I had to them. I knew my brothers, obviously, I loved them. We'd grown up very close, but I felt how I was connected to each of these people. Strange things would go on. I came out of a coma state at one point, and they were going to transfer me, so they took the respirator out, and I was able to communicate to the family exactly what I wanted for the funeral services of my wife and child, which was interesting. I told them I had been with Tamara, my wife, and I knew exactly what she wanted done with her clothes. I knew which sister-in-law got which piece of jewelry, all of it. And it wasn't coming from me. I felt as if I was having the one foot in the spirit world, one foot out of the spirit world. The most profound experience for me came almost 4.5 or 5 months into my hospital stay as I was healing. I had had most of the life-saving surgeries. I think I had 16 at that point in all. I was off of the heavy medication. I was on morphine for almost a month. They had to wean me off. I became a morphine addict in the hospital because I had a little button I could push that would give me a shot of morphine, and I used it almost as an escape from the grief as much as anything. But at the point I had this other near-death or out-of-body experience, I was off all of the heavy medications. I was just about ready to come home, and I called it a dream. I went to sleep, but I woke up in a beautiful place. And I knew, based on this experience I had had at the scene of the accident, being in this light bubble, that I was back home. And home is the word I use. It was as if I had always been there. I was home. I had that profound sense of peace and love. And I call it oneness. Everything was me, and I was everything, and everything was in perfect accord. And I walked. And in that experience, I walked down a long corridor of a beautiful building. And all I really recall in any detail is there was no panes of glass. There was these beautiful windows looking out with no panes of glass in them. And I don't know what that means or anything. But at the end of the corridor was a crib. And as I rushed to the end of the corridor and looked in the crib, there was my baby son. I whisked him up. I held him. I kissed him. I marveled that he was alive. I could feel him as tangible as anything. In fact, I felt him at a deeper sense. I felt every cell of his body and how it merged with every cell of mine, and we were tangible. I could feel his breathing. I could feel the warmth of his body. I could feel his head against my face. And as I held him, a being came up behind me, which I felt. I felt the presence of this immense divine creator. It's been 15 years. I still get emotional when I go there. And much like Bill, it's taken me 15 years to figure this all out. The experience has happened, and I would piece things together, and then other pieces would come. But as this being held me, and I held my son, just pure love and light and knowledge and understanding and comprehension flowed from him to me, and it was male. Everything seemed to make sense. What I knew in that moment, and this is the hardest part to explain, what I knew in that moment was that everything was in perfect order, and there was absolutely no judgment. I had been through so much guilt because I was driving the car. I felt as if I was responsible for taking the lives of half my family because maybe I overcorrected or did I fall asleep at the wheel. I knew in that moment that everything was in perfect order. As I stood with divinity, it's difficult sometimes to share this, but I knew in the arms of my divine creator that I was also divine, that I was a part of him, and that he was a part of me, and that I was connected. And that same oneness I was experiencing, I experienced with him. And what I knew also was that we always have a choice. In fact, he gave me the choice as I held my son to, and I can't, he didn't speak words, it was just knowing that came through me. But if I could put words to it, he communicated that he did not want me to feel victimized. He did not want me to feel hurt. And he said, I'm giving you the opportunity to give me your son so you never have to feel like he was taken from you. And in that moment of love and absolute compassion, it made perfect sense. And I kissed my little boy and put him back in the crib. And then I woke up. My younger brother was actually staying in the hospital that night with me, and I sat up in the bed. It must have been about 4 o'clock in the morning at this point, and I said, I have had the most profound dream. And he said, what happened? And I couldn't even tell him. I said, I was with Griffin. That was my little boy's name. And it's taken me 15 years to really talk about it, because things would come up all through life, or I would have another dream, and I've had encounters with my deceased wife and with my deceased son, and I think sometimes I still have 1 foot in and 1 foot out. But that was my near-death experience, or the highlights of it.
Very brief comment, and then I will basically turn the rest of the meeting over to you to ask brief questions. Let me make an observation or two right before I hand the microphone over. I've probably heard 150 or so near-death experiences from the people who have had them, and have thought about exactly what do they mean. And I have some ideas, and everyone here has their own ideas. When you get right down to it, the common thread that seems to go through them is the idea of progress, and that we are all supposed to go through experiences to grow. And keeping that in mind, maybe there are a few questions you might want to ask. And that is, if we're really supposed to be growing and progressing, why would love be perhaps the most important thing, as has been mentioned? If you can learn instantaneously almost on the other side, like some people describe, why do people get sent back here and have to struggle so much to learn, like reading a few pages in a book? What is there about effort in this life that is so important? What does it mean to feel interconnected, the way they describe it? And how is that different from this life? Stated in an opposite way, why do we not quite have that feeling of interconnectedness here that people have on the other side? What's so different? Maybe you want to ask why it is that there's this timeless sense on the other side. I've asked a lot of people about their experience. How long was it? How long were you there? I don't know. I can say it was 5 minutes or 5 years, and it wouldn't make any difference because time was really different. Stated another way, why is there such a sense of time here? Why are we here in a place where we have this sense of time? If everything is for a purpose, what about that? And why do we have such dramatic events? Liz describes being in front of a bunch of people and a black spot, and she knew exactly what it meant, and she hasn't gone into detail, but that was a life-changing event for her. Jeff lost half his family. Life-changing event for him. Bill changed from being a marathon runner to a guy who spent his adult life in a wheelchair. Dramatically changed lives. Why would things like that happen? What is the purpose of it all? How can you have somebody who just died at the same time you did telling you can't come here, it's not your time? And what does it mean that it's not your time? Just a few few minor little questions and thoughts you might have for these people on the panel or whoever else, or that you might want to think about, and some others, because I think there are some profound things that we can learn from near-death experiences. Let's invite you to ask questions. Please be succinct with them so that as many people as possible will have a chance. We'll try to wrap it up at 8:30. And then afterwards, you can come down here and talk to them personally. Questions?
Yeah, I'm just curious, Jeff, what were maybe some of the one or two or three major things in your life that changed once you went through all of this in your 6 months?
Wow. They actually amputated my left leg, so that changed. I was an athlete before. I'd been a collegiate athlete, and I lost a lot of the use of my right arm. But what changed for me was my outlook on people. I mean, having had that experience where I saw people, I really felt them and knew who they were, now I find if I really connect with people, that I can feel that, I can re-experience that and look at them and see the divinity in them, really look at them and see the Son of God instead of just the homeless guy or the guy at work or the gal at the checkout counter or whatever it might be. And that changed for me in a profound way, where I experienced people different and became far more aware of our connection to each other.
I have to say, my wife had an NDE and she told me all about it, and I don't doubt her, but I'm by nature a skeptic. So my question is, are a lot of these experiences that we hear influenced by your own religious belief or non-religious belief, or an agnostic or an atheist? Or has it ever been that an atheist has seen God in an NDE where there shouldn't be one according to his belief? So how does that play together? And then also Mr. Tanner made a comment. He said, in most of NDEs, there's a religious figure depending on your background. So aren't they all the same truth?
I've heard personally from a man named Howard Storm, who at the time he had his experience was an atheist. He was an art professor at a little university. He died on the sidewalk outside Notre Dame Cathedral. He was over there with a bunch of students. I won't go into any more detail, but he was actually quite surprised when after he died he was still around, because he was an atheist. It changed his life to the extent that when he came back, his wife, who was used to and okay with this atheist guy, wound up divorcing him, and instead of becoming a professor, he became a Unitarian minister. Dramatically changed his life. So atheist to believer, absolutely. Your other comment, I think, was really interesting about, does your religious background shape it? I once heard this fascinating lecture by a guy who'd written a bunch of books about history and was proclaimed to be objective. And when he stood up, he laughed at that, because he said, no one can be objective, because you can only experience something from what you've experienced in your life, from your life's experience. And if you've had a life experience, that's your point of view. And it's not objective. It's your point of view. And so if you're a Catholic, you're going to see an experience through a Catholic's eyes. And if you're a Baptist, you're going to see it through a Baptist's eyes. And if you're an atheist, you may change your belief a little bit by saying, maybe there's something on the other side, but it's not going to change your history. Some basic elements of what you believed may have been changed, as the basic elements of everybody who's had an experience are going to be changed. Their life's going to be altered by it, but you can't help but see your experience and describe it from the life that you have led, from the religious background or lack of it that you have experienced. I talked earlier about a Roman coming here from ancient history. If he went back, he'd describe us in ancient history Roman terminology. The same thing happens to everybody who has an NDE. Now I'll let Jeff say something really profound instead of my rambling.
No. Because it was an interesting thing. I grew up in a religious home, and part of this, it was, how does this NDE I experienced work with what I believed? And I use those words consciously, because I believed things, but having had the experience, then I knew something. I believed or grew up with a God that was going to judge me, that I was to please him, that I had things that I needed to do in order to make him happy. my experience was nothing like that. My experience was of, and I use those words, it was, nobody showed up and said, well, I'm Jesus. It was a divine creator. It was my God, but it was my Father, there was such a oneness. I was part of him and he was part of me. Reconciling that with even my religion. Is God going to judge me? Am I in trouble if I don't do this or don't do that? That's been part of this 15-year journey for me. In part of this journey, I have rarely shared this, but I was shown something profound. This was not but a few years ago. I had another one of those dreams, and in this dream, I was shown three people, and I was shown them in that same profound sense where I knew them. I was shown Gandhi and knew him at a deep level. I was shown Mother Teresa and knew her at a deep level, and I was shown Jesus, the Christ, and knew him at a deep level. And the interesting thing in my experience was I saw that religion had nothing to do with their power. Gandhi was Hindu. Mother Teresa was Christian, and Jesus was Jewish, practicing Jewish traditions right up to his crucifixion. And I was shown that the religion was not what defined them or gave them their light. It was them knowing who they were. It was them standing in the power of their divinity and saying, I am a son of God. Or Mother Teresa saying, I see the Son of God in everyone I look at. Or Gandhi saying, be the change you want to see. Be the change you want to create in the world and make a miracle. And it was a profound experience for me to see that. And here again, it related back. And I thought, oh yeah, I remember walking through the hospital and seeing people like that, feeling them like that. I still have a faith. I still practice. And I saw that, oh, okay, now I get what the greatest master to me was talking about when he said, judge not that you be not judged. Walking in that sense in the hospital and experiencing people for who they were, I knew that everyone was on their perfect path and they were different paths than mine. And that was okay because their experiences and their path was created for them, customized, just like my path had been created for me, customized. And only on that path will I ever learn what I came here to learn. And that's my experience. My experience was not a religious experience. It was a spiritual experience. And I've had to come to terms with that in my own mind, but it all fits perfectly for me. And that's the best answer I have, but it's just my experience.
One other thing I think that's important is that nobody sets out to have a near-death experience. I use the analogy that if I were sitting up at Rice-Eccles Stadium and they said that we're going to have a near-death experience in our group here, I'd be looking at the other 70,000 people, wonder who it would be. It was not something that I certainly set out for, and I'm sure Jeff and Liz would say the same thing. I struggled with faith because I was with my dad when he died. And when my father passed away, I mean, at the instant that he died, I knew something very special had just occurred. I mean, not his death. I knew that my father had somehow been transformed, that his suffering had ended. And in that instant, literally in an instant, his body went from a cancer-ravaged body that was totally lifeless for hours prior to his passing to all of the color returning, peace. Truly, there was something magical that occurred at that moment. But I always struggled with that question of what happened. For me personally, the interesting thing I found about faith was that you would think that when something so challenging as a death or a serious illness or some other catastrophe occurs in your life, that it would draw you to faith. I actually found that was the time we probably questioned, at least for me, that I questioned faith the most. It was kind of like, how could you abandon me or abandon us at this time? And it really wasn't until after I had my near-death experience that some of those answers really became quite clear. And it really had nothing to do with religion or anything else. It just really had to do with me, I guess, finding myself within the glory of that light at that moment.
For these explanations, but I do have a follow-up question, and basically triggered by what you said, Mr. Tanner, that everybody can only describe his experience by the experience that he had in his life. Now, from the way I understand it, a near-death experience, or in that situation, you're not in this life anymore. You're in another sphere. Shouldn't that sphere be the same for everybody? But everybody sees it differently. Everybody has another experience.
If I could interject, though, you're going into an environment that is so different than anything that you've ever experienced. It's like Martin said, just literally try to imagine some time in your life where you showed up someplace where you had no idea where you were, and you had this incredible experience while you were there, and then you come back to your reality and you're trying to explain to other people about this incredible journey that you just took, but they're looking at you with blank stares because they're going, I don't know what you're talking about. It doesn't really resonate with anything that I know at this level. That's kind of the struggle I think you find with anybody that's really had a near-death experience is that terms you will commonly hear is it's kind of like this, or it's similar to this. You can draw comparisons, but you're not going to get there. You're trying to explain an experience from a mortal perspective. When people ask me about the colors, I go, I can't even begin to tell you. There's only one thing I've seen since my experience. I don't know if you ever saw the movie What Dreams May Come that Robin Williams was in. There was a scene where he found himself kind of in a similar situation as I did with in this beautiful, all of these colors. The only thing that I could think of at that moment is whoever the director or the writer was, they had to have had an NDE because he was in a place that was so beautiful, but yet was so foreign to him. It was like, how do you describe it?
Well, everybody's telling about the additional information they picked up when they got back. And I was wondering if she didn't later on through from when it happened to now, that you felt like it was the right thing to do?
Well, I have four lovely children. I know it was the right thing to do. I knew it at the time. I said okay to come back. I just didn't want to. I didn't want to come back to the pain or this world. It was so nice over there.
So it wasn't against your will. She just didn't want to come back.
Right. I finally said yes, I would. And so it wasn't against my will. I did change my heart. And Father asked, when he asked me to, I couldn't refuse it. So
I have a question about the involvement of those on the other side with us. How aware are they of us and how involved are they in our lives?
I would say that they are incredibly aware of you and involved in every aspect, pretty much, of your life on a daily basis. and they can be pretty funny about it, too.
I would agree. We're the ones that are not aware, that they are acutely aware. In fact, when I passed and my wife was there in that same state saying, you have to go back, you've got to go back, and she was distraught and upset, as was I, but even in a place of peace and beauty, she was angry, she was upset, she was mortified that I had to go back. And I think I felt her mourn with me in the coming months and through the years of me being alone, and they're very, very aware.
I would agree. My mother passed away a little over a year ago. I was with her at the time that she passed. Even though I'd had the experience and I knew she was going to be okay, it's very difficult. You still have the mortal aspect of our life, which is the grief and everything else. It's kind of like at a very deep spiritual level, you know somebody is okay, but you still really miss their presence. About 6 weeks after my mother died, I was back in my room putting some things away, and I live alone, and I had a sense that there was somebody behind me. You know how you sense when somebody's behind you. And I sat up and I turned around and there was nothing there. But at that instance, the room filled up with her perfume. It only lasted for about 3 seconds. My mother wore a very distinct perfume. And it was just such a kind of a loving, comforting thing that I felt. But then the mortal side of me, the light switch clicked on, and it was like, I need to verify this. And I went to every room in the house, and I checked everything just to make sure that there was no other explanation for what I had just experienced. And because I kept having this lingering question after my mother passed, I just always, in my thoughts and, if you will, in my prayers, it was just, I want to know you're okay. That answered that question.
I have read hundreds of near-death experiences, and I find it very interesting hearing your three experiences side by side, because it echoes the commonalities that are found in all near-death experiences, but it also brings out the idea that there are profound differences in your experiences. I find it hard to believe that the differences are random. If they're not random, it seems to me that someone is orchestrating these experiences. Did you get the feeling that your experiences were orchestrated, and why?
That's a very interesting question. In my experience, they were absolutely orchestrated and interesting enough by me. I was at cause. As I stood with my divine creator contemplating what had gone on, there was a complete knowing and understanding and comprehension that we did this together. You came to learn this. I only came here to learn, and we had orchestrated together the perfect experience that would teach me what I came here to get, and I'm getting my money's worth, and that was beautiful, and everybody, that's the thing, it was all beautiful, and it was orchestrated, dare I say, by me. All of our experiences are created in many ways by us, and yet I did have a God or a divine father creator there with me saying, do you see what we've created and how that's going to serve you and how it is serving you?
Any of you have thoughts about how to reconcile the idea that you're expressing of things are set, there's this pattern, nothing is out of order, there's this plan, life is as it is, it's kind of set, but there's free will and you can choose to do whatever you want? I have an idea about that, but I'd like to hear what you say.
I truly believe that we do all orchestrate our experiences, and it, like he said, we're here to learn. I just needed to be reminded. That was all. I got reminded.
I don't know. Like I said, I came back with more questions than answers, so I'm still struggling. The one thing in a later aspect of the experience, I was really dealing with some anger and doubt and everything else, but the two things that I got very clear about is that there were two real gifts that we as mankind live by, and that is the ability to love, and to love unconditionally is the first gift that we were given. And the second was free agency, and that through that free agency, we have the power to create incredible good. We also have the ability to create incredible evil, and that that is part of the human experience, is that free agency. There will not really be an interference in those gifts. You're going to have to choose what you do with that free agency.
Before we leave that topic real quick, I'll make one like 10-second comment. I had always had this really difficult time understanding how you can have free will and everything was just known and set. And then I talked to a guy a few years ago who had near-death experience, and he said, well, don't tell me you never filled out a calendar or a day planner before. And I said, well, yeah, I've done that. Well, didn't you use your free will to plan your future a little bit? And I said, yeah. And he said, that's the best analogy I can give you. People, and we heard, what was his name, who had cystic fibrosis, who died and was very angry. Don, thank you. Don Wood. He was very angry because he had cystic fibrosis and he was going to die and miss out on his wife and kids. When he had his first of a couple of near-death experiences, he saw himself, or he was shown how before he came to this life, he was in some classroom and people are saying, well, you have all these learning opportunities and here's some of the things you can sign up for that'll give you extra learning, like cancer, cystic fibrosis, and he sees himself in the classroom, cystic fibrosis, raising his hand, and he's going, oh, what was I thinking? But the gist of it was that we plan our lives, even some of the harsh things, because we learn from them. There is no real contradiction when you understand it from that perspective, that there is a plan, but there is free will.
Really quickly, I think the things happen. What I learned in this exchange in giving my son back was explaining this. If I said to my creator, I really want to be forgiving like you, he would create situations in my life that I would really get to forgive people to learn that. But in giving my son back in that whole exchange, what I learned is we may not know what's happening to us in life, but we're always at choices at how we experience it. The catastrophe may have been planned and put in some cosmic day planner at some point. As it occurs in our lives, we are always at choice to say, okay, I'm going to be a victim and become, or I'm going to choose to experience it differently. We get to walk in free will and agency of how we experience our lives. And I do believe we put in a planner somewhere that, yeah, I want to learn this. The universe in its love said, okay, we'll let you learn that.
Liz, I'm very interested in the comment you made about looking into a white stone to see what life would be like. Can you tell me where was the stone, what the stone looked like, and were you in an inside or outside?
I was in a room. It was kind of like on a raised round pillar, and it was probably taller than I was. And there were seats around this white stone, and I could look into it and see future things that I was supposed to do.
Was it milky, solid, or, you know, how did you see? Was it kind of like a movie screen?
It was kind of like a movie type of screen. I could see clearly the images. It was like a clear crystal at that point. But when it stopped, it was opaque, white.
Thank you.
Roy Mills goes into quite a bit of detail in his book, Earth is Not Our Home, about the planning of his life. There was something I didn't even dare ask that I wanted to do. And then before I was leaving to come here, Father said, okay. My question is, did you have a sense, and I think Liz really spoke to this the best, did you have a sense that your NDE may have been given to you for the purpose of a course correction so that you might accomplish the things that you wanted to before you were born, but that life and the world and stuff were taking you a different way?
Yes, I believe that to be the truth. 'Cause he showed me all of the people that had hurt me and what had happened to them. And he did. He told me that this is what has happened to them has made them feel sick. And it's like a virus. They come in contact with other people and pass this virus along. He says, but you don't have to. You don't have to do that. You can change it. It can be okay. It can be good. You can change bad things into good things. And I understood exactly what he meant, and I've tried to do that ever since.
I guess I'm lucky I have relatives here that can either vouch for me or condemn me. I don't know. In all reality, the person that I was prior to that experience did die. I came back physically looking the same, but my perspective on life, my belief system, my physical being, my priorities, everything changed. And there was a 180-degree shift. All of the elements that were in my life before were still there, but how they changed, I guess the best analogy that I can make, are you familiar with Maslow's hierarchy, the theory, kind of the pyramid? I looked at it like my pyramid still existed, it just went inverted. That all of the things that I had really put the least priority on, i.e. relationships and some of those things, now all of a sudden became right at the top. Probably the most interesting thing was trying to reestablish a relationship with my children. They're like, who is this guy? You know, I would tell my kids I loved them and how important they were to me. And by the way, now we have an incredible relationship, but they really struggled with we've had an invasion of the body snatchers here. Somebody came in and took the guy that we knew as Dad and put him back in this pod, and now we need to figure out how to deal with this guy. And it was really that dramatic. Kay, my cousin's wife, is down here, and she'd probably be the person you'd want to talk to after the meeting, kind of tell you. It was pretty dramatic.
I have a daughter that was up for a liver transplant. She carried a beeper for 4 years. She went through many, many, many operations and spiritual experiences. And she says, "Don't cry for me, Mom." She says, "All of this suffering that we go through are actually blessings." And I couldn't understand that. But I understand more when I read and hear what she meant. And she kept me strong when she was suffering. After 4 years, she got her liver, but she didn't make it. I want to thank all of you. This is the most wonderful experiences in the world. But I can't help but wonder, the people that don't believe in you and think you're crazy, do you feel that you are here to give them some spirituality, or do you just ignore them, or you think they're part of your job?
Me personally, yes. I smile because I know that when they get to that jumping off point, that they're going to go, "Oh, man, they were right." Oh, my heck. We're just the messenger.
But how do you handle that? How do you handle these people?
I just smile and thank them and for their opinion, and it doesn't faze me. I know what happened.
I'll give you a little history of how I came to IONS. As I had indicated, I had my experience in 1991. I was in the hospital for about a year, and when I came home, I happened to hear a radio program that Martin was actually hosting. He was announcing the very first meeting of IONS, and he told a little bit about what IONS was about and about the meeting. And I attended, and that first meeting, there was probably about 15 or 20 people. I didn't go there for validation. I didn't go there really, and I knew the experience that I had was very real. I went there to see if there were other people that had had this same experience. And you're going to find that people that have NDEs don't go around wearing buttons or hats that said, "I've had an NDE and I'm here to change you or the world." That's really not what it's about. The message, from my perspective, again, it's an opinion, is that the near-death experience is individual in nature, but the message from the NDE is universal, and there are things that you get from the NDE that apply to all of us. There's nothing magical. There's nothing mysterious about it. It's not like the person that's had an NDE has the keys to the kingdom. At best, the person who's had an NDE has had a peek, just a peek. And it reinforces in that individual, in me, it reinforced a belief in faith. It answered that question of what happens after, am I going to just die and be in a box and that's it? And what I got out of it is the fact that really all this body is the vehicle that gets who we truly are around while we're down here. I will once again be reunited with those people that I've loved and lost. But you aren't going to see me out there beating a drum. You aren't going to see me out there trying to convert people. If people have a question about my experience, I'll tell them about my experience. What they get out of it is totally up to them, and I respect that.
My question is kind of for all of you, but Liz and Jeff, you both said something that really stood out to me. First of all, Liz, you mentioned that you'd struggled with drugs. You died with an accidental drug overdose. And my background is I work with addicts, and I was married to somebody who struggled with addictions for 17 years. So I've seen a lot of that and how horrific it can be. There's two questions. First of all, in my experience, when people struggle with these kinds of things, they've kind of lost a sense of themselves. They don't know who they are. And Jeff, you mentioned that a little bit. They've disconnected from who they were created to be. In going through these experiences and there being no judgment, at that point when you experienced that, was there not a sense of good or bad or right or wrong? Our choices don't make us good or bad, we just are. Is that what you were both trying to say?
I feel that that is the way it is. I think there are things that we do that limit our experience. I was on a fast track to destroy myself pretty quickly. And I wouldn't have gotten the chances or the learning experience or get to do what I needed to do here. And so it was kind of a course correction for me. With the drug addiction, it kind of, I think it was in place to cover up all of the things that had hurt me up to that point. After I had my experience, I didn't use anymore, and I wasn't angry anymore. Does that help?
It does, and hopefully my question was clear. My other question was for Jeff. You had mentioned the difference between religion and spirituality, and I've always kind of believed that just because we're religious doesn't mean we're spiritual, and that spirituality is really having a sense of peace. Could you speak more to that?
Yeah, and that was my experience. I had a bit of a course correction because in my previous life, and I feel like I kind of died and came back a different person, but I thought it was a competition. I was very competitive. I was going to get to heaven and to hell with the rest of you. It was kind of like I was on this competitive about it. I was going to make it. I was going to do the things. Religion can be an effective vehicle to spirituality, and it cannot be. Again, it's all our choice. But for me, when I stood in that divine realm, there was no good or bad. There was no right or wrong. There just was, and I was the one placing judgment on it. Oh, I lost my wife and son. That was bad, as I put it. But in that divine light, no, this is exactly what you came to learn. Therefore, it's good. I've grown more in my darkest hours than I ever have in my happy times. We place judgments on things. My divine creator doesn't. He just watches. I've used the analogy of when I was watching my little boys learn to walk, and they'd get up and toddle around and fall down and slobber, and I didn't judge that good or bad. I knew they were just learning, and I loved them. I loved every step. I loved their progress. I loved where they were, and they were perfect to me right where they were. I began to understand things that Jesus said when he said, be perfect. He didn't say become perfect. He said, be perfect. Just stand in your place and be exactly as you were created to be. And that was the command. It wasn't, oh, there's something to become. It was embrace who you are, embrace how much you're loved, and know that you are one with the Father just like I am. Greater things you'll do than I if you just believe. Come on, Peter, walk on the water. Why do you doubt? And encouraging us to really stand in our magnificence rather than be judged and hurt and afraid. He always said, fear not, but be believing.
It's all very validating. Thank you, all of you.
It seems that there's got to be a point to every culture throughout the world having similar type of patterns of near-death experiences that become rituals that are illustrated in artworks. You know, like Hieronymus Bosch shows the tunnel. There's artworks that show the spirit floating above the body, Christ descending to the spirit world, and paradise is there. So the question is, with all these different cultures having similar types of experiences, there's got to be a point that the ancient and modern people are trying to teach us. And so what would be that point?
There is a great book out there by a lady named Carol Zaleski. It's not so easy to find, it's out of print, but she did something that has really never been done before or since with near-death experiences. She found them in all kinds of writings throughout the ages, and so you have these near-death experiences of people from the Middle Ages and a little after and before, and the gist of it is that Durrell is right. There have been near-death experiences in all times, as near as we can tell. Paul kind of describes going to heaven in the body or out. He doesn't know, and he doesn't really go into detail about it. And it sounds like something very, very similar. Obviously, there is a connection through great religious leaders, like Jeff was mentioning, through near-death experiences for what I would describe as us ordinary people rather than the great religious leaders. There's always a connection with heaven and the other side. And I think it's just a way of keeping the connection and trying to give us the course corrections that we need along the way. Beyond that, I really wouldn't speculate.
One other question would be, this gets into the idea of diversity that we see on this side with different types of faiths, and it seems like the same type of thing exists on the other side, which I think is about is free agency. So is on the other side, like here, is there different levels of truth that are being taught according to how people can grasp those truths? And is there any end to learning truths and how you can find the, what is the truth?
I don't know if there's an end to learning or if there's a progression. I think the point is, though, is that we come into this lower vibration, into this mortality, almost to experience what we're not, so that eventually we can embrace what we are or who we are. And so throughout the ages and even these ancient things, since the experience, I've studied Native American shaman ceremonies and Jewish mysticism, and all of these things have this pattern of almost a circular, not a linear, but an eternal round of progressing through experience, and yet always being divine, but experiencing the undivine, and then embracing the divinity and going about that whole program. So I don't know if we ever stop learning. I hope not, because I'm still learning, and I think it would be boring to know everything.
I would just agree. I don't think there is an end to learning at all. I don't.
Remember the woman that was caught in adultery, and the Savior said, "Neither do I judge you. Go thy way and sin no more." There is also judgment, but it comes in the future, and we'll all stand before our Maker and be held accountable for what we do. And it's interesting that we learn that we're not going to be judged by being ecclesiastical individual, a minister or a bishop or something. We're going to be judged by our works. That some churches have gotten around that and just teaches the fun side, but it's there. And the Lord has made sure that people know that he is there for centuries going on and on. So we see primitive people all have some belief in God, and they might come from that.
Thank you, Bill and Liz and Jeff, for being on our panel tonight.